is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to find out more about plans by the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District to seek out Gary-based contractors to work on projects. We have with us the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District, Tammy Davis. Tammy, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris. I'm so happy to be here with you.
If you will talk a little bit about the sanitary district for folks who may not be familiar with what the district is all about, and the fact that you have not only the sanitary district but also the stormwater management district under your purvey. Tell us a little bit about the agencies first.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so the Gary Sanitary District, it is a wastewater treatment plant. We process sewer and wastewater. So we have a combined sewer system, meaning that both of those factors flow into our pipes. So that sewer water as well as wastewater. So we strive to be environmentally conscious, environmentally focused, and we process sewage and wastewater not only for Gary, but also for Hobart, Lake Station, and Maryville communities.
How long has the district been in operation? But probably almost about as long as the city of Gary's been in operation.
Almost. Yeah. I think we actually started in like 1938 or something like that. So we've been around for several decades, and we've gone under a number of improvements, both at our lift stations, within the community. Some people may have seen like the big, large cylinders, you know, where we are helping to ensure that there is adequate flow throughout our sewer systems. So we've been around a long time and have been quite progressive.
When you talk about the sanitary district seeking out Gary-based contractors, maybe we should mention, first, what are some of the projects that the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District are undergoing this year?
Sure. I'm very proud to announce the partnership that we have with the Army Corps of Engineers. We have done a number of projects through them, and most of that has been through funding that Congressman Pete Visclosky has been able to obtain for us through grants called the 219 grants. Mm-hmm. So we're very happy to have that partnership because many of the projects cost millions of dollars. And so it's through these partnerships and these other funding opportunities that we have those partnerships. So, for example, one of the projects that we're doing with the Army Corps of Engineers is the Lake Street Sewer Separation Project that's going on the Lake Street area in Miller, in Gary. They being with the Army Corps, another project, finished on 32nd and Broadway. It was a flow modification project that we had going on. And so right now, there is a project. It's located on 29th and Jerry Street. Currently, it's on hold, but that project will be coming up online relatively soon. We have projects going on Clark Road. There's another one, a street drainage improvement project that is coming on 4th and Bigger Streets in Gary. And on the stormwater side, we have a project going on at 5th and Montgomery.
When you set up the projects within the sanitary district, most of them, I guess, primarily involving handling stormwater as well as trying to separate the sewers, I suppose, because I know that's in many, many cities has been the big problem, trying to deal with not only sanitary waste going into the sewers, what normally people would consider, but also you've got the stormwater overflow. And we know here in the city of Gary that's a problem trying to keep the sanitary district equipment handling just this regular sanitary waste as opposed to whatever comes down whenever we have the rains.
Right. So, as I mentioned earlier, we have a combined sewer system, one of the oldest probably in the state, if not the country, to the point where we have both sewer and wastewater coming into the same pipes. So we do have the risk of what's called a combined sewer overflow. And that just really happens when we have a heavy rain. That's, you know, not much that we can do about it. But the projects that we have going on throughout the community helps to to address some of the challenges that we face in having a combined sewer system. And so as we have these projects that go on in our communities, we want to make sure that the contractors that will bid on and ultimately work on the projects are as conscious of the community as they are with the environmental concerns that we have in our city.
Tell us what work has been done already in getting contractors, and particularly ones that have workers at least companies that are based in Gary to be able to work on these projects.
Absolutely. So when the Gary Sanitary District goes out for a bid, we ensure that in the bidding documents we include the policies and practices that we would expect the contractors to adhere to relative to identifying local, meaning Gary, contractors and Gary construction workers. We hold pre-bid meetings where a majority of those I attend to reiterate the importance of having local Gary contractors, suppliers, as well as construction workers.
How difficult has it been to be able to get people involved in the process that are basically based in Gary, have employees based in Gary?
To some degree, Chris, it has been challenging because we make sure that not only do we place the requirements in the bidding documents, but we reach out to the schools, we reach out to the churches. Last year, we held the Northwest Indiana Compliance Forum, and as a part of that forum, we had a Gary resident trade fair where we put flyers all over the community. We sent press releases. You know, we went everywhere scouring around the community to get Gary residents to come to the trade fair so that our contractors could meet them, mm-hmm. right, and begin to build their own individual database of Gary residents to work on the projects. But as contractors are submitting their what's called their certified payrolls to me to review, I'm consistently seeing a decline of Gary residents. And so that's why I sent out the email blast, because I need some assistance in identifying Gary residents that are either already a journeyman or are an apprentice, so I could get them in front of our contractors.
We're talking with Tammy Davis, who's the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the City of Gary's Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District. They're together, or they're also separate as well. And you've mentioned about the fact that you've been looking for Gary-based contractors on the projects. Have you had much luck, I guess, in getting in back any of the email blast so far?
Actually, we have. I have seen a few Gary residents to respond to that email. I have someone that's a plumber, electrician, a carpenter. And when I go back into the office to check my email, I hope that there will be more. We do have some local Gary contractors that have responded with our procurement registration form to identify themselves. We know they're out there, but we want to make sure that we're making ourselves accessible and approachable to those. So anybody out there, here's my plug, Chris, before you ask me. We need Gary contractors. We need Gary suppliers. We need Gary construction workers. So if you're out there, if you know of anyone, please have them to contact me. May I leave my telephone number and email address?
Yes, go ahead.
They can reach out to me via email at Tammy, T-A-M-M-I, at GarySan, that's GarySan.com. My number to the office is 219-944-0595, extension 1824. We need plumbers. We need operating engineers. We need carpenters. We need cement masons and some laborers. We really need those in the skilled trades, if you will. So if you're out there, let me know who you are. We've got work for you.
Is this a problem or an issue, I suppose, that is more exclusive to the Sanitary District or pretty much all of Gary City government?
It's a challenge throughout the country, actually, and, mm-hmm. and Gary is not alone. There are a number of surrounding communities that have a local hiring ordinance similar to Gary, but not the same. East Chicago has one, Hammond, and I believe Michigan City has a local hiring workforce. But it's a challenge, I believe, for all communities that's trying to find local residents. But then when we get into looking for minorities and women, that number gets even smaller. And so we, and speaking with a number of the trades, their challenge now is that they have a number of union workers that are retiring. And they need to, you know, repopulate the books with the next generation of construction workers. So it's a regional challenge, Chris. It's not just specific to Gary, but because that's the community that I, you know, represent, I have to speak on our behalf. But there is a challenge. We know that there are a number of young people that's out there. They're being exposed to going to college. They're being told about careers in the military. But when it comes to construction, I constantly hear that that's not something that they're told is a career option while they're in high school or in college. And we need to change that conversation.
Are you finding that that through your efforts working with the city of Gary in particular, that the skilled trades are in turn getting their apprenticeship programs supported as well? Or is this something that you're working especially hard for the city of Gary, but it seems to be narrowed down to the fact that none of the trades are getting all the apprentices they'd like to have?
Well, it's a well, first of all, let me say I'm very proud to have the support of my executive director and the mayor to ensure that local Gary residents and local Gary contractors are provided employment and contracting opportunities on our projects. Mm-hmm. So I'm fortunate in that regard to have that high level of support. In regards to the apprenticeships, it is a challenge, but we do have a good line of communication and working relationship with the apprenticeship coordinators of nearly every trade. We have a good relationship on the journeyman side and speaking with many of the business agents. So it is a collective effort of trying to get more, particularly minorities and women, involved into the construction trades.
We know this is an effort that the overall Center for Workforce Innovation is trying to support. They've been trying to get the word out, I know, and get all the trades together. Do you think that this is going to be a problem? Are you finding that the efforts that the state is having to try to boost more people involved in going into the trades as opposed to going into college and helping get you off in the right direction?
Well, you know, we have a good relationship working with Linda Woloshansky. I've known her for years, love working with her. And last year, the Center for Workforce Innovation, the Work One Centers, and the Construction Advancement Foundation, they held a hands-on construction trades career fair at the Lake County Fairgrounds. And it was widely supported by nearly every school in Lake and LaPorte County. And so it's those types of initiatives that's needed to expose our children to the actual trades. The hands-on allowed them to get a feel for what it means to be an electrician, what it means to be a technical engineer, what it means to be an iron worker. So that type of hands-on exposure it's very critical. But it is, again, it's a collective effort. So where the state is trying to go in regards to apprenticeships begins with making sure that all the communities in Northwest Indiana are made aware of the careers in construction. And I emphasize careers because it's not just about working in the field. Mm-hmm. They need project managers. They need people that are in the marketing. You know, so there are all types of career opportunities in construction. I just think that our school system could do a more aggressive job in letting high schoolers know that there are other careers in construction.
Do you think that this is just another project that, in particular, the Gary Community Schools, although they have their own issues to deal with, that they're trying to help make sure that young people across the city of Gary and the region as well know that these are job opportunities that are out there, these are career opportunities that are out there?
Absolutely. Everybody's got things that's going on. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast in our country right now. But I think that in terms of our school corporation, they still have a responsibility in terms of educating our children, educating them with the text book, but also educating them with career options. And so to the degree that we can ensure that they are made aware of, if they educate in more, you know, inform the students that there are careers in construction, some students, you know, may not feel so lost in terms of having options if they don't want to go to college. And for those who aren't interested in going into the military, they could see construction because there's good paying jobs. I mean, some people in construction make up more than $100,000 a year. And so those salaries and wages, they need to be made aware of.
Tammy Davis is the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the Sanitary District in Gary and the Stormwater Management District in Gary. And thank you for spending time with us to talk about your particular needs and how you are trying to work with all the other trades, in particular in Northwest Indiana, to get young people involved and educated as well. And we hope that you'll be back with us again soon to bring us updates and keep us informed as to what the Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District are doing to be able to get the people to be able to get these projects done. Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Attorney General Curtis Hill went before reporters today, and he has denied the allegations that he had groped four women at a party back in March. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith was among the reporters at the news conference, and he talks more about the comments that Hill has made, his comments for the first time since the allegations became public.
Curtis Hill addressed the media for about 7 minutes. He decried what he calls a lack of fairness into the allegations against him and subsequent calls to resign from the governor and legislative leaders.
These false allegations have irretrievably damaged my reputation.
He did not answer any questions.
I anticipate and welcome the opportunity to have my side heard through a proper investigation, and therefore, I won't be taking questions today in anticipation of that opportunity in that investigation.
Hill wants the Marion County prosecutor to investigate the allegations. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
When Dean Foods decided to end its procurement contracts with some 27 of its 28 Hoosier farmers, experts have been concerned about the ramifications it might have on Indiana's agriculture, and some farmers were lucky enough to be able to find new markets for their milk, others were not. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brock Turner tells us that farmers were initially confident that they might be able to find new markets, but the reps they've had a chance to talk to regularly said they're not so concerned that they'll find homes. And Brock says that has led some to be able to take some desperate measures in order to be able to keep their farms going.
When Dean Foods decided to end procurement contracts with 27 of its 28 Hoosier farmers, dairy experts worried about the ramifications. Many farmers were optimistic they'd be able to sell their milk somewhere else. But as WFIU's Brock Turner reports, the demand just isn't there anymore. And a lot of farmers are having to rethink their futures.
John Claycamp says dairy farming is in his blood. He's been the owner of Lot Hill Dairy Farm in Jackson County for nearly 30 years. With his wife by his side, he's raised four kids and hundreds of cattle.
Now those cows, you know, they get breakfast first, and they get dinner first, and that's just the way it is.
Claycamp grew up on the farm. He and his father still work 7 days a week to ensure the cows are happy and healthy. He says there is nothing else he'd rather be doing.
Right or wrong, they always come first. You know, cows are out, cows having calves, cows need milk, and they need fed. That's just the way it is, and you do tend to put that before everything else.
This pasture in rural Jackson County was once home to more than 100 dairy cows. Now, Claycamp milks less than 40. The rising costs of feed and supplies paired with a decreased demand for milk has caused farmers like John across Indiana and the nation to cut the number of cows they milk. In 1975, the average American drank 8.5 ounces of liquid milk every day. Today, Americans drink about 5 ounces. Indiana Dairy Producers Executive Director Doug Lehman says farmers across Indiana will continue to be forced to make difficult decisions about their futures.
You know, we got to be real about it.
Lehman was a dairy farmer for nearly 40 years. He raised his family on the farm. But in 2011, Lehman quit milking cows because the margins were too slim to support his family. He says it was the hardest decision of his life.
Life does go on after milking cows. I can attest to that myself, so there is life after milking cows. I want people to understand that, too. We're not wanting anybody to have to get out, but some may have to make those tough decisions.
Two out of every three Indiana dairy farms have closed up shop since 1997. That year, there were nearly 3,000 dairy farms in Indiana. Today, there are less than 1,000, and the situation continues to get worse.
We're all helpless at this time. There's not really anything I can personally do to come out and affect them getting to market. We can help with the communications, and that's what I'm trying to do. But, you know, we cannot force somebody to take them on as a customer.
It is unclear exactly why Dean Foods pulled contracts from nearly all Hoosier farmers. The company declined to comment for this story, but in a statement wrote increased competition and the introduction of new plants at a time when there is an industry-wide surplus of fluid milk, processing capacity forced us into this position. During what Dean Foods called a period of overproduction, the state recently celebrated the opening of another plant. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb says the plant is a win for everyone involved.
The area farmers and all the folks that we're going to be able to supply and stock in, including five states. But at the end of the day, this is a huge win for consumers.
This new Walmart facility in Fort Wayne is one of the largest in the country. Some former Dean Foods producers got contracts from Walmart, but not all of them. It's estimated that six producers in Indiana haven't found a new market. Clay Camp is among them. He admits the easiest thing to do would be to sell his dairy farm, but he doesn't want to leave the industry he's dedicated his life to without putting up a fight. That's why every Saturday he attends a local farmer's market in Seymour.
How can I help you? I am sold out. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
He loads up his trailer and brings coolers filled with gelato, milk, and cheese.
The only thing I have left is Pepper Jack. I'm not Walmart. I don't need to make millions of dollars a year. I just want to make the farm payment, you know, and that's it.
Isn't that wonderful? Here's a spoon.
In the meantime, Clay Camp will savor every moment he gets with his cows out on the pasture, and he'll keep fine-tuning his recipes. Folks debate whether his chocolate milk has too much chocolate or not enough. For now, he's going to stick with his current recipe. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
Thank you. Hey, you come back and tell me how that was, okay? All right, bye-bye.
And Indiana social workers recently received the National Social Worker of the Year Award from the National Association of Social Workers. Purdue University's Kimber Nicole Martinez was recognized for developing a statewide program that would help prevent sexual violence in underserved and was in turn marginalized. Emphasis on social workers and farm workers in particular. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan had a chance to talk with Nicolette Martinez recently, who is the director of the statewide multicultural effort to help prevent social abuse, which is organized, is called MESA.
Tell us where your work started, when you realized, you know, there's a great need for this in Indiana, and I have to do this.
Well, my work actually started was with my academic advisor at Purdue University. I'm a Purdue alum. I was a single mother, and I had three daughters, and I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse. Was always wanting to make a difference in the world, and I worked as a farm worker as a child and have a passion for farm worker communities. And so to me, it was a natural fit when I came to Purdue to work at CARE Communities Against Rape Initiative that we start doing outreach with farm worker communities.
And you actually created the first farm worker child sexual abuse prevention program. What did that look like, and how did you come up with that idea?
Well, that was built upon work that I started in CARE, where we were doing sexual violence prevention work. I actually had heard some stories along the way where people had disclosed things to me. They said, you know, Kimber, we're having some problems with our daughter, and she cries every night at dinner. And for the family, they thought it was a behavioral issue. And to me, it looked like possible symptoms of a child that was being sexually abused.
Well, obviously, you know, you're passionate about working with those that are underrepresented. Is there a great need for that here in Indiana?
There is a great need for that in Indiana. And the thing is that for a lot of people in these communities, they're not able to get their needs met by going through mainstream efforts, or services aren't available that are culturally appropriate for those communities. For a lot of marginalized communities, sometimes like with the farm worker community, when I first started doing that work, people were surprised to find out that there were migrant farm workers in Indiana.
Children here in Indiana, you know, in families and these populations, what are the risks that some of these children are facing?
in a recent study, farm worker women, 90% of farm worker women say that they face sexual harassment in the field. And sexual harassment ranges from any kind of behavior from, you know, lewd name calling to actual rape. And so, and because of labor laws regarding, you know, seasonal and farm work, you often have underage people under employment law. They might say, you know, that they're a victim of sexual harassment, when in reality, it's a child who's been sexually assaulted. You know, risk factors for child sexual abuse has to do with income, female-headed households, limited English capacity, a lot of the same risk factors for sexual violence.
Your work as a social worker, I want to talk about that broadly. I think there's a greater understanding of the need for social workers.
Really, social work really looks at empowering and advocating for people, whether, you know, regardless of the setting. So it can be in a school-based setting, it can be in a medical setting, and it's really about providing unconditional positive regard for humans, right, for people, and at the same time helping create access and social justice for those people.
Your program here, we're sitting at Purdue University, first campus-based violence prevention program for people LGBTQ, bilingual, bicultural. What success has that program has had, and what's that looked like here?
So really looking at a primary prevention approach and looking at how is gender-based violence, where does it start? And so it starts in institutions, right? So if we can create institutions that embrace people, as well as addressing the more personal level of violence prevention, which comes at the interpersonal level.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There are a lot of things happening with films in the city of Gary these days, and not only things that have happened, but things that are coming up for the summer months as well. Let's turn now to the lady who has founded and is the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival. Karen Turing is with us to talk about it. Karen, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hey, thanks.
Well, first let's take here a look at what has happened, because I know that before we start to actually talk about the upcoming 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival, which is coming up in October, let's talk first about the collaboration that you all have had with the City of Gary, working in an art house, a social kitchen, which is the official name of the building there right across the street from the baseball park. But there have been a lot of films that have been shown in recent months here that I think people in Gary have enjoyed. Tell us about them.
We did a pretty comprehensive survey in 2017 about what the audience wants from the Gary International Black Film Festival. So, you know, because that's how we program, you know, based on what people say they want to see and what they want to talk about. And one of the things that the consistent theme that kept coming up was we want films in our community. We want you to come to where we are. And we tried that in 2016 and 2017, just wherever someone wanted us to be, we would go there, we would set up the equipment, but we found that conditions were rarely ideal, you know, for a theatrical film screening. And so we reached out to the art house and asked, well, what would it look like if we were to basically convert the space into sort of a theater, mm-hmm. you know, a mini cinema. And they said yes, and we said yes. And for the last 5 months, we've been screening a monthly film and culinary series. So, you know, Art House, the Social Kitchen, is a partnership that was developed to encourage entrepreneurial chefs, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were like, oh, great. I love eating while watching movies. So we got with the art house, and they paired a chef with each of the films, and we tried to keep the food somewhat thematic throughout the series. And, yeah. and that was pretty successful. The first time, we had just a few people. They were like, what? You movie, dinner and a movie in the same place? So we had a few people show up, and then these last two screenings, one we invited the Michigan City Steppers, because we did a film that was about a young girl who was part of a step team. So the Steppers came and brought their families, and we also had, you know, sort of a food that was that young people like, for example, you know, so the chefs basically prepared, you know, something that was more amenable to young folks. And it was pretty successful. And then just this past week, we showed a film about historically black colleges and universities, and we brought in the Black Greeks, the Kappa Alpha Psi's, and that was also a pretty successful event. So
That's great.
We might want to continue that, of, you know, sort of bringing in the chefs, letting them try out their special dishes based on a theme, you know, because chefs are artists as well, and they, you know, they like that challenge. And then bring in the community in to watch your film, talk about it, and have some really great food.
Now, we know that on television, there was a program dinner and a movie where basically they had chefs come on and prepare things. And of course, then they showed the movie on TV. But this is better still. This is actually a theater where people can sit and not only enjoy the meal, but watch a film, too. That sounds like a very interesting idea. And I'm certainly sure that others in the community are hoping that you'll be able to bring that back next year, to be sure. Now, besides besides the film series that you finished up on, one coming up here is, because it's summer, it's going to be time for Movies in the Park, which is, I know, the collaboration that you all have with the City of Gary at Marquette Park. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we also have one of the things that because we are a submissions festival, which means that filmmakers from around the world submit their films to the film festival, and we have a group of folks that volunteer and actually review those films and may help us make those selections for the festival. But we get a lot of short films. And, you know, there's really no place for a filmmaker who has made a short film for their films to get screened before a larger audience. And so we reached out to the City of Gary and we said, what if we did a short film right before the film that in the Movies in the Park? And that way these artists continue to get some kind of, you know, exposure for their films. And so the first film they screened in June was Black Panther. And we were like, okay, let's find a really good short sci-fi related film and pair that with the feature film. And so throughout this summer, every time there is a Movies in the Park, you'll see a short film from an independent filmmaker right before the main feature, and that helps us to continue to help these artists get their pieces out.
That's great.
To the community.
That's going to be great. It'd be very interesting, and certainly will promote the annual Gary International Black Film Festival as well, too, because I'm sure that the people that will see these independent films ahead of the main feature will know about this, and maybe that'll get them interested in getting involved in the film festival come this fall, to be sure. That's very interesting.
Exactly.
How much work do you have to do in coordinating all this with the City of Gary?
The City of Gary is pretty easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
well, that's good to know.
So far they've really been gracious and generous and helping us to, you know, move audiences to the film. So we're pretty pleased with that partnership.
That's right. We're talking with Karen Toering, who is a native of Gary, Indiana, and amongst all of her duties and work, she is the founder and the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival, which, by the way, coming up will be the from 2018 will be the 8th annual such film festival, and it's going to happen in the second week of October. If you will now, Karen, let's focus in on the big festival itself coming up. First are some of the big features that are going to be available for people to see if they attend the festival this year?
Well, right now we're in the process. Okay, first of all, first things first, the festival is October 12th through the 14th. Mm-hmm. It's going to be at Indiana University Northwest, one of our longtime partners, at the Berglund Auditorium, which is the smaller auditorium on the campus. And We are in the process right now of reviewing films. So if there are filmmakers out there that would like for their films to be screened in the festival and they want us to take a look, they can submit by going to our website, and that is gibff.org, to submit your film. So we're screening right now. We're hoping to have, we've got a couple of films that we've curated, which means we've reached out to the filmmaker and asked to screen their film. And I don't want to reveal the names yet, because that's always the best part.
Oh, sure.
Is learning, you know, about who's going to be at the film festival. Plus, we haven't locked the schedule in. We don't normally do that until September, 1 month before the film festival. We lock the schedule in, and then we start telling people, okay, this is the film. One of the things that always happens every year is people go, well, what films do you have? And if we give you the list of all of the films, there's a 99% chance that you've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
But what we guarantee is that the film is going to be powerful. It's going to move you in different ways. You're going to laugh. You're going to think. You're going to go, I didn't know that about that particular thing or country or person. And that's what we guarantee to deliver.
I guess, as it was happened in past film festivals, that there have been a very interesting mix of films, of narrative and documentaries and dramas, shorts, and animated works. It runs the gamut, I guess, of whatever the genre happens to have available. So it's worth checking out by going to IU Northwest, to the Berglund Auditorium, for the festival coming up. Also, too, I know that you have built into the festival some other special events that come along, too. Among them are some other special celebrations that are happening, and something called a Gary Showcase. These are things that happen every single year?
Yes, they happen. We kind of just fell into that the first year that we launched the film festival. We brought in, for the opener, we brought in a little-known independent filmmaker at the time. Her name is Ava DuVernay. Now, everybody knows Ava DuVernay for Selma and 13th and Queen Sugar and what's the one about the Disney one that she just did? Anyway, a filmmaker who was at the time emerging, and 8 years later, she's doing $100 million films. But the other thing that we did was that we dedicated Sundays, which is the last day of the film festival, to a local filmmaker. And we actually, the first year, we didn't know that this would be a continuing sort of thing, but it's turned out that folks really, really like to see local filmmakers highlighted and represented in the festival. So Sundays are always Gary Day. So you're always going to see a film that has a deep connection to Gary on Sunday. I shouldn't say always, because you should never say that, right?
Well, yeah, then you hope for the best. You hope that you have that, you know, every single year.
Yes.
I'm sure,
yes, but we, you know, every year. And because, you know, that's the other thing that we have learned as film festival programmers, is that there's a lot of talent in Gary. A lot of talent in Gary. And so far, 8 years running, we've been able to show a film to close the festival that has a direct connection to Gary. So we feel pretty lucky about that.
That's great. Well, Karen, we are going to have to get back in touch and get you on again here once we have a better idea of what the schedule looks like here as the 8th annual Gary International Black Film Festival gets underway this year. It's going to be October 12th through the 14th. It'll be in Berglund Auditorium, which is on the IU Northwest campus in Gary, of course. And Karen Towing, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about not only the projects that you're working on ahead of the film festival, but a little clue for folks that maybe are not familiar with what the International Black Film Festival is all about. They'll certainly look into it more, and we'll have you back on to talk in more detail about it a little closer to the event. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Kentucky has one of the worst outbreaks of hepatitis A in the country. The liver disease has spread to several states, including Indiana. Side Effects Public Media's Emily Foreman introduces us to a nurse who's on Indiana's front lines trying to stop the disease.
Obsessed with hepatitis A.
It's her job to track down every person exposed to the virus in Clark County, Indiana. She has worked overtime for the past 6 months, and she's finally taking a vacation.
And I guarantee it, along the way, I'll be talking about hepatitis A in the airport. I'll be talking about hepatitis A wherever I go. I never stop.
John started paying attention to hepatitis A last November. She knew about the outbreak in Louisville, Kentucky, just across the Ohio River. A month later, a woman who was transferred from Louisville to the Clark County Jail started to show symptoms: jaundice and vomiting. She had hepatitis A, and it soon spread to five of her jailmates.
So in the jail, we've made some rules where we quarantine anybody that's become positive. If they're symptomatic, we quarantine them because they are so close quartered there, and maybe five, six, seven girls share one bathroom and one bunk area together.
Hepatitis A is a hygiene problem. It's hard to keep clean when you live in a jail or don't have a home. You get the liver disease if you ingest even a trace amount of fecal matter from someone who has it. There's no treatment, but most people become immune after a few weeks. John's heard about her next case from the hospital. She interviewed the sick man and found out that he and his wife had just come from Louisville.
They were living in a camp, and the camp got shut down, bulldozed over.
This was the second case linked to Kentucky. Johns isn't surprised why Clark County now has the highest number of confirmed hepatitis A cases in Indiana.
People come over back and forth because we're only a walking bridge away, like a mile from Louisville.
Dr. Lori Kaloya is the medical director at Louisville's health department.
I started my job here at the health department on November 20th, and the following day is when the state of Kentucky declared the hepatitis A outbreak, so I'm not quite sure what my job would look like without hepatitis A at this point.
Now, in Kentucky, there have been more than 950 cases of hepatitis A. Six people have died. The last time Kentucky had an outbreak this big was back in 1988. The culprit? Contaminated lettuce. This time, it's different.
The main risk that we see is drug-related spread of illness across the state border.
This hepatitis A outbreak appears to be the ripple effect of drug use and homelessness. When the CDC tested Kentucky's very first cases, they found the virus's genetic characteristics matched cases in San Diego. That city also had a large outbreak amongst its homeless population. And John says she sees this trend here in Indiana.
They're out on the streets, and we don't know exactly where they're staying. They may be staying in abandoned houses. They may be staying at different camp locations across the county.
But John's has found these people at a soup kitchen, at a motel, even under viaducts, in the woods. So far, she's met 60 people who have hepatitis A. She gives them hand sanitizer and offers vaccines to anyone they've come in contact with.
Are you worried about going on vacation?
Yeah.
It's hard to let go because the virus continues to spread, and it's reached other Indiana counties.
Kind of going northwest as we speak in the state. So I think it's going to probably get a little worse before it gets better.
She's right. Just last week, Ohio declared a hepatitis A outbreak, too. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
Columbia City's current population is about 8,500, and it's mostly white. But the number of Hispanic and Latinos has gone up as Puerto Ricans take advantage of a job transfer off the island to create a home in Columbia City. Warsaw-based Zimmer Biomet is located about 29 miles west of Columbia City. They also have a plant in Puerto Rico. And after Hurricane Maria, Zimmer asked some of their Puerto Rican employees if they would relocate to plants in the continental U.S., like the one in Warsaw. Local officials helped welcome the new residents, but Columbia City Mayor Ryan Daniel had some concerns. When he heard the news, he worried about housing and whether the new residents would feel welcomed.
We're really kind of insulated in Columbia City, which is weird, but we are very, very white, English-speaking individuals here in Columbia City. We have had very few individuals from, we'll say, other cultures or other languages that have been here and moved here to Columbia City. And so this actually provides both a challenge and an opportunity for us.
Daniel added that when a new group of people move into a community like Columbia City, it does stir up conversations, especially on social media.
But I will say the vast amount of discussions that we have had, easily 20-1, has been very positive and just helping people to understand the what, when, why, where, and how we've heard back is people saying, hey, I'm not great in Spanish, but I know a little bit and I'd love to help.
One of those residents ready to help is Richard Gerber. He works at the local YMCA and has a new role.
I guess I'm the teacher. I guess that's my title. And I also work here at the Y as a wellness coach.
Gerber found out about the new residents after watching the local news one night. The next day, he was approached by his boss.
She met me out in the lobby here and she said, Richard, I got a question for you, you know, and she said, do you know a lot of Puerto Ricans are moving here? And I said, yeah, I just saw that. And she said, how about teaching English for us? I said, sure.
He has some thoughts about whether the community is ready for the change the new residents could bring.
Some people have a problem with these, quote, immigrants coming here to live off of welfare and take our jobs. Well, no, they're coming, specialized jobs. They are American, United States citizens. They're just transferring. And they are going to be contributing to the economy here and certainly to the culture.
Mercy Stella Gonzalez Perez is one of the new residents that is now calling Columbia City home. She arrived in January and lives with her dad and her dog in an apartment complex.
We came here with other several families, and we kind of live on the same place. Some of them live in Warsaw. We're all pretty close. We got to know each other better here. The rest of my family, such as my mom, my brother, and my grandmother, they still live in Puerto Rico. But we're kind of expecting my mom to come here and maybe in the summer or next semester, hopefully. But as of now, it's just me and my dad.
Gonzalez Perez is from Ponce, Puerto Rico. She recently graduated from college and is continuing her studies. Her dad works for Zimmer Biomet, and she found work at Coesi Elementary School as a paraprofessional, where she helps Spanish-speaking students that are learning English. She says things have gone well so far, but there will always be challenges.
Obviously, it hasn't been an easy transition. It hasn't been easy getting used to the weather, getting used to the change of the atmosphere. Most of the families don't speak English fluently. Maybe only one member of the family, but not all of them speak fluent English, so I think that's very hard for most of the families.
Mayor Daniel says they're rolling out information, making sure the community is informed and welcoming to the new residents.
We thought it was very important to just inform the community, first of all, of who these families were. Good, hardworking families. And these are American citizens. You know, that's one of the biggest misperceptions that we really had to fight was Puerto Rico is not a part of Mexico. Let's start there, okay? Puerto Rico is an American protectorate. So we had to overcome those barriers. But certainly as the mayor of a small community, it's my job to be a cheerleader.
During the initial wave, about 50 Zimmer employees relocated to Indiana. A second wave of Puerto Ricans is expected to arrive after spouses and children move to Columbia City this summer. The city says they are ready. They have translated city documents and their park information, even flyers promoting their new Centro Acuático, or Aquatic Center. For WBOI News, I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana.
And now with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jeff Casey, the managing director of the Toll Performing Arts Company.
Very good.
Was that it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was good.
The Toll Performing Arts Company, formerly known as the Toll Theater in downtown Hammond on Homan Avenue. Actually, is Homan Avenue your address?
It is. Yep.
Okay, even though we enter off the alley.
Yeah, well, either way.
You can
front
enter.
Front or back.
That's true. Okay. So, Jeff, you have ever so many things going on all the time.
Yes, we do, indeed.
Tell us about you have a children's show coming up.
We do. So several years ago, we wrote an original children's musical called Pickle Chiffon Pie, based on the Roger Bradfield book by the same name. And we collaborated with Roger to adapt it for the stage. And at that time, we toured it throughout elementary schools in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And it's a great show, and it was a great program, but it was also overwhelming at that capacity to book and travel, et cetera.
Oh, uh-huh.
So this summer, we're remounting the show. However, we're doing it at the Toll.
Uh-huh.
So the four Saturday mornings in July at 10 a.m., family-friendly all the way down to itty-bitty kids, which you typically can't take to theater.
Right.
We've removed all of the chairs on the main level of seating so the kids can just put their little butts right on there and be close to the action. And it's a great little musical. It's being performed by five very talented young people, some of whom are in our youth ensemble. Some are brand new to us. Mm-hmm. It's a story about compassion and sharing and kindness to others. Mm-hmm. One of the components that we're really excited about, and we appreciate the support of Franciscan to help us be able to offer this detail, is we're doing Spanish subtitles for the whole show. So families in Hammond that maybe typically don't feel like they have access to live theater can come and still enjoy the performance.
So that's like on a monitor?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it'll run through the whole piece. Mm-hmm. And tickets are only $5. Mm. So it's really a community building effort for us. We want people to come out, enjoy the show, spend a little bit of time with us. They can do a meet and greet with the cast and the characters. Mm-hmm. So it's really about introducing itty bitties to theater and hoping that that becomes a lifelong
interest,
passion, and habit for them.
Yes. So your youth ensemble, how long has that been in existence now?
Since 2010.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we're now at a full circle moment. A really cool thing happened this year. So Roe Ogrentz, who was one of our founding members of the youth ensemble back in 2010, after she graduated high school, she attended DePaul University in Chicago, studying theater with an emphasis in theater for young audiences. And we just recently hired Roe as our education associate.
Oh, nice.
So she's now running the program that she helped start as a student. So it's really cool to have her on staff, and it's nice to have someone kind of taking things over and leading that in a different direction.
Yeah, good. We've had that at South Shore Arts twice now. Somebody who – well, Jillian, who was our former education director, had been an award winner in the high school show.
Oh, yeah.
And now her successor, Micah – had been as well.
That is awesome.
And like during my time in the late 90s. So it's like, oh, really? You're an adult now? How dare you? And what else is coming up? What adult shows?
Yeah, so we're super excited to be presenting the Indiana State premiere of Fun Home, the musical. It was the groundbreaking 2015 Tony Award-winning musical. It's the first Broadway show to have ever featured a lesbian as the lead protagonist character. That had never happened on Broadway, which is kind of ridiculous.
There certainly have been lesbians.
Indeed. It also was the first all-female production team for a Broadway show. And the team of Fun Home breaking that glass ceiling had opened the doors for Waitress, the musical that's still on Broadway, also has an all-female production team. So it's called Fun Home, not Fun House. Big difference. Right. And it's short for Funeral Home because Alison Bechdel, who is the lesbian that the show is based on, her graphic novel autobiography is about her growing up in the environment of a funeral home.
Oh, interesting. Like 6 feet and, under, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an interesting subject matter. It the lead character is presented at three different ages. At 9, when she first starts realizing something's different, but she doesn't know what it is. At 19, when she has her first lesbian experience in college. Mm-hmm. And then at 43, as an adult and the same age as her father was when he killed himself. So it's this reflective – it's just a really interesting show.
And this is a play.
It's a musical.
It's a musical.
It's a musical.
I asked because I wanted to clarify. Doesn't sound like a tap dancing Ruby Keelering off into the wings.
No Bugsby Berkeley numbers in this.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for being here to tell us about what's coming up, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. On behalf of Chris Noti, thanks for joining us. Hope you'll be back with us tomorrow.